Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is the first Moroccan and pregnant woman to win France's most prestigious literary prize, the Goncourt. A journalist and frequent commentator on women's and human rights, she's French President Emmanuel Macron's personal representative for the promotion of the French language and culture. Born in Morocco, she now lives in Paris with her French husband and their two young children. And her latest book, just translated into English as Lullaby, is an international bestseller. Leila Slimani, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hello.
Now, you were born in 1981 in Rabat and into what seems like really unusual circumstances. Your mother was a real model of freedom and independence.
Yes, she was very independent and she was a sort of a workaholic. She loved her job. She was a doctor and she was one of the first female doctors in Morocco. So she was very committed to her job. And at the same time, she was a very good mother. She adored us and she taught us a lot of things. And my parents were very, very free and they teach us that we had to be very free human beings and that we could do everything we want to do and that we should feel free to invent ourselves.
And your father had a stellar career too.
Yes, yes, my father was a banker and he was the Minister of Finance of Morocco, so he had a big career too, yeah.
So tell me about that childhood, growing up in what really outside of the confines of your family home was quite a repressive society.
Yes, because it was during the reign of Hassan II. He was a kind of a tyrant. He was a very hard king, very violent. So we knew that we couldn't speak out loud, that we had to be very careful. But at the same time, we had a lot of fun with my family because my family was very funny and very diverse because my grandmother, she was from Alsace in France. I had an uncle who came from Poland and was Jew. So we have every religion and every nationality in my family. So it was very, very funny.
What were your first literary memories?
I think that it's text and essay that I wrote when I was like 8. And I remember that my mother told me, I know you're going to be a writer. And I don't know if I'm a writer because my mother told me during my whole childhood that I was going to be a writer and that I want to please her, or if she was right and she knew that it was going to happen. So I don't know, but I became a writer.
And you studied in France, didn't you?
Yes, I studied in France. I left Morocco when I was 18 and I studied in France literature, philosophy and political science.
You thought, though, that you wanted to be an actress?
Yes, I wanted to be an actress because, you know, I love fiction and I love characters. And maybe like in the movie, you know, the Woody Allen movie, I wanted to go into the screen, like in the Rose of Cairo. But then I discovered that it's not a job for me because I hate waiting and I hate the casting and I hate the fact that someone is telling me what to do. So I'd rather write the story myself and be the one who decides what my character are going to do.
Did you actually do much in the way of movies or theatre?
No, not much. I just went to Le Cours Florent, which is a very famous school of acting, but that's all.
And then journalism came calling. So when did you decide, actually, that the shift to writing would happen?
You know, I was a reporter and I was traveling a lot. And when I had my son, it was very difficult for me to travel a lot and to leave my child at home in Paris. And I was like, maybe I should stop being a reporter and start writing a book. And the other thing was, I was always saying to all my friends and the people I knew, you know what, one day I'm going to write a novel. And I was very afraid to become a 50-year-old woman saying to all her friends, you know, I'm going to write a book one day. And I was very afraid of having regrets. So I decided to take 2 years. I'm going to write a book. If it works, it's good. If it doesn't work, I will never say again, I'm going to write a book. And it worked.
It's worked spectacularly well. Well, actually, hasn't it? Well, let's talk about your first book, about Dakhla.
Ah, Dakhla Bey, yeah. This is not really a novel. This is a photograph book, and I just wrote the legend of the book.
And so that was your first venture, though, into publishing.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
And then we get into In the Garden of the Ogre. Now, this, I understand, was inspired by the scandal of the disgraced former IMF chief, Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Yes, I had the idea when I saw for the first time the image of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, you know, in New York, and he was devastated, of course. And I had the idea of a character who could be a sex addict, but a woman. I wanted my character to be a woman, and I wanted to explore what is it for a woman to have such an addiction.
So in terms of Strauss Kahn himself, I mean, that must have been, through your father's work, a world that you were familiar with.
Yes, but actually my character is a journalist, so I was familiar with the journalism. So my character is a reporter, she's a journalist, but she's very lazy and she's not ambitious. And for me, it was very interesting to write about a female character who doesn't really care about her work. And I think what is very subversive in a way in my character is that she doesn't care. She's very passive. And she doesn't really care about her work, about her children, and about what people are thinking of her.
And it's also very unusual to write about sex addiction from a female point of view.
Yes, it's very unusual. I think I've never read a novel about this.
No, no. What is her philosophy? Where does she come to from that?
You know, I think she's very unhappy. She's very lonely, and she's trying to... She feels a sort of void inside herself, but she doesn't know why. And she thinks that maybe sex is going to give her something to fulfill her, but it doesn't. I think she's a sad character.
Mm. And we'll come back to this later, because you've also written extensively about Moroccan women and sex. But that particular book won a big book award in Morocco. Is it the La Mamounia Literary Award? So that must have changed things for you.
I was very happy because, you know, it's a book that is very... hard, very harsh, and it's a book about sex. And I was very surprised that in Morocco they could give me such a prize with a topic like sex addiction. So I was very happy with this.
And then, of course, this book that really changed absolutely everything. It's called Lullaby in English, 76,000 copies printed within 3 months of it coming out. It won the Prix Goncourt, the most prestigious French literature prize. It made you the most read author in France in 2016. Now, it's inspired by a true life crime. Tell us.
I wouldn't say inspired. I would say that this true crime gave me the idea of the book, but it's not really inspired because I invented everything. Everything is fiction. I wanted to explore the worst fear and the worst nightmare of every parent, the killing of your children, not the fact that someone could harm your children.
By a trusted person.
By a trusted person. And you know, when you hire a nanny, you have to trust someone that you don't know. Actually, you know nothing about the nanny you hire. So I wanted to explore this, the fact that you absolutely don't know the person that you have to trust.
And that really complex relationship of almost codependency between carer and mother.
Yes, it's a very, very strange relationship because it's a relationship of power. The mother and the father are the boss, obviously, and she's the employee. But at the same time, the nanny has a sort of power too, because she has a power over the children. She's the one who is responsible for their security. So I wanted to explore this. And also, I think that there is a sort of hypocrisy in this relationship, because everyone is doing as if the nanny was a member of the family, as if she was one of ours. Everyone is telling her, wow, you're a member of the family. But everyone knows that it's not true. It's a sort of hypocrisy.
And of course, you've lived this in various incarnations. You had a nanny as a child. You possibly employ a nanny. You have children. You have seen this from every possible point of view.
Yes, I tried to. When I was a child, I remember that even as a little child, I could feel and I could understand that my nanny was sometimes very sad and even sometimes very humiliated by her position, because she was living with us. She loved us. But at the end of the day, we were always asking, where is mom? Because we wanted to see our mom, and she was not our mom. And, you know, she couldn't write and she couldn't read. And I remember that in a certain way, she was jealous of my mother, because we could share a lot of intellectual things with my mother that we couldn't share with her. In a certain way, I think I wanted to pay tribute to her and to all the nannies that I've met, all the women that makes it possible for us working mother to go out of the house and to have the life that we have today.
As a mother yourself, then, what do you hope for your children?
I hope for my children to be free. It's really, really the value that is the most important in my life. I hope they will be free of mind, and that they will have the ability to do whatever they want. I hope they won't care about what people are thinking or people judging. I hope them to be free.
It's the most shocking thing, particularly for a mother, to read. I mean, the tagline, "The baby is dead, it only took a few seconds." And it just absolutely goes to the heart of any mother reading it. Now, you were pregnant when you won the prize, but you already had a child when you wrote it.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I told you I wanted to explore my own fears. I tried to use my emotions to write the book. And in a certain way, it was a sort of catharsis. It was a way for me to get rid of my own anxiety and to give my anxiety to my reader. Sorry.
You've been quoted as saying that you don't believe in maternal instinct.
No, I don't. I think it's, as Simone de Beauvoir, as Elisabeth Badinter, I think it's a pure invention of the patriarchal system to say to women, you know, you've been born to be mothers, and when you are going to be mothers, you have the duty to be happy. And I think it's absolutely false. And we don't, first of all, I think we don't have the duty of being happy when we are mothers. And I think that it's not the only goal of a woman's life.
Absolutely. This is a book that explores so many of those ideas in so many different layers. It's also a thriller, but it's not a whodunit. It's more of a why done it.
Exactly. That's why I decided to begin with the murder, because I wanted my reader to be a sort of investigator and to try to understand why such a terrific thing happened in a normal family. And in a certain way, I like the idea that the parents ignores everything, but the reader knows more than the parents. So he's going to look at every details that the parents are ignoring. And sometimes he wants to warn the parents. He wants to tell them, be careful, she's going to kill your children. And I like this idea.
A job a little bit like a nanny, I suppose, is that of a translator. And of course, this has been translated by Sam Taylor. And it is very much that nurturing of something that belongs to somebody else and presenting it to the world. How easy is it for you to work in translation?
You know, Sam Taylor was a terrific translator. He did a wonderful job. And I'm very, very happy with this translation, because I think that he understood very well what I wanted. I wanted to be very clear in my writing, very clinical. And I think that he has been very faithful to the French version. And we worked a lot together. He emailed me. He asked me a lot of questions. And it was a very good dialogue between us.
And yet your English is perfect. Why do you need a translator?
No. I couldn't translate it myself. Impossible.
Now, in your writing, you talk about inequality a lot. The main inequality you discuss is sex. And I wonder why that and not career, for example.
No, I think I discuss about career, sex. Everything is related, you know. I think that I believe a lot in what we call in French intersectionality. I think intersectionality in English. I think that everything is related, of course. But as a novelist, you don't want to be exhaustive. You want just to tell a story, and then the reader can find whatever he wants in the story you are telling him.
And class divide, of course, is also very, very important to you.
Yes, of course. And I think that in the relationship between Myriam, the mother, and Louise, there is a sort of fight of class. They are not really fighting, because it's not violence. And there is the violence of the murder. But before the murder, there is no violence between Myriam and Louise. But at the same time, Louise feels very humiliated. And she feels that she's underclassed because she's doing a job of immigrant. And she's a white woman doing a job of immigrant. So she feels very lonely when she goes to the playground, for example. She doesn't belong to a group, to the different groups of nannies, the African group, the Asian group. So, of course, this is also a book about class.
So this book, absolutely huge and suddenly really established you in the literary firmament. But you didn't stop there. I think you had three books in the last year. So The Devil is in the Detail. And now that brings together texts that you wrote for a newspaper that dedicates each issue to one sole topic. Tell me a little about that.
Yes, and what is extraordinary is that I wrote all these pieces between, I think, 2014 and 2015. So during the Paris attack of Bataclan, Charlie Hebdo. So I wrote a lot of pieces about extremism, about terrorism. And it was a way for me to tell my emotions as a Parisian, as a woman, as a human being about all those topics. And as a Moroccan too, because obviously as a girl who was born in a Muslim country, it was interesting for me to give my point of view. So it was quite extraordinary to write for the man called Eric Fotorino, who is the director of this newspaper.
And then we get on to sex and lies, and this is what we were talking about earlier, sexual life in Morocco. And it's really about Moroccan women living in an Arab world where sex is consumed as a commodity, but of course it's for them, it's a very restrictive. You're either a whore or a virgin, as you say.
You have to know that in Morocco, in a lot of Muslim countries, sexual relationships are forbidden when you're not married. You can go to prison. Homosexuality is forbidden. Cheating on your husband or on your wife is forbidden and you can go to prison. So today in prison in Morocco, you can find homosexuals and you can find adulterous people. So I think it's a shame and I think everyone should fight against this. So I wanted women in Morocco to tell me how they live in such a country and how can they live their sexual life in a country who thinks that you can only be a virgin or a wife.
And so you went around and spoke to women and got their stories from them. How easy was that? Were people happy to confide in you?
Yes, actually, it was very easy because I think that women was really eager to break silence and to tell someone who is not going to judge them. Because, you know, one of the great invention of a patriarchy is silence and shame, telling women you should shut up and you should be ashamed of what you want to say. And I think that feminism should always say to women, break the silence, say what you have to say. And when you say I, when you begin to tell your story, you have the feeling that maybe you have a dignity. And maybe you're not the piece of shit everyone is telling you you are. So as a novelist, as a writer, but also as a feminist, I think it's very important for me to give a voice to those women.
And was there one theme that came through in what they were saying?
Hypocrisy. A lot of women were telling me that they are suffering of the hypocrisy because everyone knows that woman has a sexual life because men are having the sexual life with those women. Men are sleeping with the woman and then they are saying to them, now you're not a virgin, so I'm not going to marry you. So it's very unfair for women because men have, in a certain way, they have the menu and they can choose whatever they want. Women, they don't have the choice.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this book came out just really on the brink of the Time's Up campaign and the hashtag Me Too. How much have those campaigns filtered through into that society?
Not so much or not enough, I think. But I think that there is a sort of, I'm optimistic because I think that the more women are going to be educated in Morocco, the more they are going to work to have a sort of financial independence and the more they will want to break silence and to say that this society is very unfair to them. And it's not possible to have the same duties as men, to pay taxes, but at the end of the day, not to have the same right and not to inherit, for example, the same as a man. So I'm very optimistic that Moroccan women are going to fight for their rights.
Mm-hmm. When you're very aware of what's going on in countries like Morocco, how do you feel seeing very privileged people, perhaps actresses wearing black dresses or whatever it is, people claiming victimhood? I'm talking about the Me Too campaign, when you have really seen people who genuinely are victims.
When I was a little girl, when I was watching TV and I was watching the Oscars, I was looking up at those women and I wanted to be like them. So I think maybe it can be a good example for a lot of women who are listening to beautiful and powerful women and are saying, wow, this woman can live such a terrible thing. She can be harassed like me. So I'm not a piece of shit. I'm like her and she's like me. So I think there is no hierarchy. It's not just a problem of you're white and you're rich. No, we live all the same experience. That's what's stunning and terrifying at the same time. Even if we are poor, if we are rich, we live the same experience.
And we're not diluting that experience, the awful experience that some women have been through by claiming to be one of them?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that now is a moment for sorority and we should try to find a way to have a sort of solidarity between us and to be very careful not to find ways that will divide us because it's the best way not to win this fight. We have to win the fight and then maybe we can make those kinds of differences of nuance. But it's very important, first of all, to win this fight.
And do you think that it stimulated the dialogue in France? Are people talking about these issues now?
Yes, people are talking about these issues. But at the same time, you know, I think in the Western countries, we are dealing with a sort of identity crisis. France, as Great Britain, as United States, for example, I have the feeling that they are asking themselves, who are we? What is our place in the world now? What it is to be French? I'm not sure we have the answer yet. It's a very difficult question, of course, and I try to give my own answer, but it's very difficult.
And so you come straight off the back of this book into a comic book. Tell me about Words of Honor.
You know, I wanted young people, especially in Morocco, to read the book and to be aware of all the topics I'm dealing with. And in Morocco, young people, they don't read a lot, and especially they don't read essays. So I found that maybe a comic will make it possible for them to read about those topics that are very, very important for the next generations.
And what were the stories that you're trying to impart to the youngsters?
It's the same stories, actually, as in Sex and Lies. We try to adapt the story, the real stories that I have collected in Sex and Lies, to put them into a comics.
Now, French language and culture. The president, Emmanuel Macron, asked you to be in charge of that, basically, for the country. What does that mean, and what are you doing with it?
First of all, I represent France inside the International Organization of Francophonie, so it's like a role of an ambassador. And I'm going to organize a lot of cultural events to promote and to defend French language. I'm going to organize in the media, but also in various parts of the world, in China, in Korea, to make people know more about the French culture and the French language.
It's such an honor.
Yes, it's such an honor, and it's very, you know, it's extraordinary because, for example, in China, it's a lot of people are learning French now in China because Chinese people are investing a lot in Africa, so they need to learn French to go in Africa. And a lot of Chinese learn French in Canada. So I met a lot of Chinese people telling me, you know, I lived in Canada to learn French and then I went to Africa. So it's extraordinary because you meet people who have very good stories to tell you, and I like this.
Macron actually invited you to come and see him. You were one of the first people he wanted to meet.
Yeah, maybe not one of the first, but yes, he asked me to meet him.
And is there truth in the rumour that he actually asked you to be the Minister for Culture?
We discussed about this, but, you know, he pretty quickly understand that I'm too free to be a minister.
And too busy. I mean, this is a prolific, prolific output. What drives you, Leila?
Desire, I think, and it's something magical. I lost my dad 15 years ago, and my dad has a very tragic life. And maybe I want to say all he wanted to say, and I'm here to make him live again.
With writing so much, how do you manage it? You've got two young children. I know you have help, but what's your process?
You know, I write all the time, but I try to keep some time for my children. I travel a lot. I do as a lot of women in the world. I do my best. I do my best to try to have it all and to do everything at the same time. Sometimes I do it wrong and sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes I feel guilty because I'm not with my children. But I do my best and I think it's enough.
And in terms of actually sitting down and doing the work, do you need to be in a particular room? Can you do it on trains? Can you do
No, I need to be alone. I need to be alone and I need to be in my office in Paris or in Normandy. I have a house in the country, but I can't work in a cafe. I can't work in a train. It's impossible for me because I need silence and I need to be alone. I had the idea that someone is looking at me when I'm writing. I don't like this.
And what's next for you?
Another book, of course.
Can you tell us anything about it?
No. No, I can't. It has to be a secret or I don't want to write it if people know what it is.
Well, all I can say is I'm looking forward to it. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Tremendously. Leila, thank you so much for coming
in. Thank you very much.
Leila's book is Lullaby. It's by Leila Slimani and it's published by Faber and it's out in English now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.